The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Imagine launching a car off of a ramp. Your maximum acceleration combined with maximum ramp angle launches the vehicle into space. There is an apex where velocity is at its max, and then energy is lost. And markets are no different. You've got flows of liquidity which drive prices, and prices can increase more and more quickly. But to sustain that, it takes more and more liquidity.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I went back and read a quote this week from George Orwell that I think pretty much summarizes the way things feel right now in this country with the election, with the central banking, the general deceit that we seem to have. George Orwell said, "During times of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act." Doesn't it feel that way, Dave? It seems like George Orwell hit the nail on the head 70 years ago when he said that.
Well, that's right. It reminds me of Oliver Sacks and his little piece on aphasiacs, who, you know, really are almost brain dead most of the time, unless there's something deceitful or duplicitous which is being spoken, and then they can't help but laugh uproariously.
Because they know it's deceit.
Because they know it's deceit. And although they appear to be comatose and almost lifeless 98% of the time, if a lie is put in front of them, they laugh hilariously. It's this great little vignette of a fine-tuned element. They have this BSO-meter. And the way that Oliver Sacks found it was during the context of elections, because every 2 years there was this crazy thing that happened in the aphasiacs ward. And so it was, you know, you look at deceit and you look at honesty, and yes, it's become a novelty to tell the truth, particularly in an election season.
Well, we seem to have a lot of truth and deceit coming at the same time. I mean, they'd be laughing their heads off, like you said, because we have the WikiLeaks coming out, and there are so many amazing revelations coming out through WikiLeaks, yet the Russians are being blamed. Okay, so I guess Vladimir Putin is the expert at the internet.
But interesting that better evidence is actually that the security community is a part of this and not actually the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's being revealed that it could be within the NSA itself that this information's coming out.
Right, and in fact that Clinton is not the desired candidate in terms of the intelligence community, what they would prefer. You know, Podesta, as you know, was right there in the campaign with Hillary, and you see the same kind of shenanigans being played with polling numbers.
Right.
And polling numbers are today telling us that there's a widening gap between Clinton and Trump, and yet the sampling for the polls that are being done.
The policy of oversampling came from Podesta.
Well, that's right. And this is from an email directly from his inbox. Would you like to know what Podesta has said in his inbox? In this day and age where there is no privacy, I can tell you exactly what Podesta said. I also want to get your Atlas folks to recommend oversamples for our polling because we start in February by market, regions, etc. I want to get all this compiled into one set of recommendations so we can maximize what we get out of our media polling. And it's very fascinating because right now, Kevin, they're taking the tact that we just need to assume that Trump is buried, he's done, we're going to move on and start discussing the Senate and the House as if that's all that's left to talk about because Clinton's right. Already won the election. So the Democratic strategy is the polling's already given us the election result, so let's just move on.
Well, and that was part of the strategy. Another Podesta email basically said 2 weeks before the election, let's declare Hillary a winner and then move on to Congress.
Right. And it's fascinating because there is a bit of a repeat or an echo from history where Democrats had a major lead coming into the election. I'm thinking Carter and Reagan.
Yeah.
And then the Republicans actually, by the time we got to the end of October, the sentiment was, no, he's buried. He's a goon from Hollywood. And yet he won in a landslide. So fascinating that since 1972, you've got Democrats who've polled much better in the August and September months, and then finally in October, again, this goes back to 1932, October, you start to see a return to more accurate polling, and the conjecture there is that the groups that are doing the polling do want to keep a bit of their integrity intact, and so they go back to normal polling practices just before the election, but you've got this August-September timeframe,
right,
where they're intentionally oversampling certain people groups so that it gives the result they want and gives basically free advertising to the person that they hope is elected.
So this really is not new. Now, let's say that these strategies don't work and the letting everyone know that the victory has already been attained by the Democratic Party doesn't work. You still have voting machines, Dave, and I hate to say it, you know, remnants of Hugo Chavez. If you go back and look at Venezuela, the same voting machine company that George Soros is connected to, they're the ones who supplied the voting machines in Venezuela. And back in 2006, people were crying foul. They were saying, wait a second, this thing was rigged.
That's right. If you pay a little extra, you can have your Smartmatic counting machines designate who voted for whom on a pre-established basis. Now, I'm kidding, of course.
Well, and we have 16 key states here in the United States that are using those machines that were provided by Soros.
It's interesting. You know, I'm sure you watched the last election debate.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, this back and forth about, you know, you're trying to let the Russians undermine the election process. At the same time, we have smoking gun emails, again, provided by WikiLeaks, that show the DNC funding the disruption at the events in Chicago.
Right.
And it's like, well, so is there a connection between Trump and Russia? Don't think there is, but if there is, the DNC certainly doesn't mind disrupting the election process themselves, which categorically, when we're talking to our kids, that's the pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah, telling these guys that you'll pay them to start a fight at a Trump rally.
And then insisting, when the election results are in, you promise you're not going to contest it, right? And I'm thinking to myself, but what if there's a hanging chat?
Right.
What if there's a hanging chad? We've been down this road before where Democrats have themselves contested an election and have filed lawsuits towards that end. Why would a Republican not be able to do that? I have to tell you, quite frankly, I've already voted. My election vote is in. My mail-in ballot I put in the mail today, and I didn't vote for either of these. My conscience would not allow me to. I realize I'm open to criticism now from 100% of the population that knows me, some whom are Democrats and some whom are Republicans. But my conscience and the rationale, which I can share with my children, is perfectly clear. And what I've demonstrated to them, I think, is completely defensible.
Well, and this is causing division in my own household. There are some who believe, look, you've got to vote because look at the other side. Or there's those who say, look, we'll never have a solution to this unless we write somebody in and start doing that on a more regular basis.
Well, on our ballots here in the state of Colorado, Lawrence Kotlikoff showed up.
Yeah.
And it was a surprise to me because I didn't know he was running.
He's an economist, isn't
That's
he?
Right.
I mean, we had him on the show. He did offer a solution to the budget problem.
While I didn't vote for him, one of the things that I do appreciate is that he's willing to put something out there.
Right.
The world is full of critics and not very many creators. Hmm. And it's interesting to see someone actually craft a proposal and say, well, try this on for size. And yes, it's open for criticism, but so much better is something put on the table that's been creatively thought through
right.
than just the armchair critic who never does anything and only has criticisms of what other people say and suggest.
Well, one thing this election has done, it's put the establishment on notice. Pat Buchanan wrote a great piece this week talking about the fear that the establishment, the entrenched establishment now has. They know that they have to fear the people. Now, Hillary may win, or the establishment may win this election, probably will win the election, who knows? But there's a fear, and we see it in the central banking community as well, Dave. You know, the volatility index, which is a means of seeing trades going up and down, you know, what is the price of stocks or 10-year treasuries or gold? That volatility index has almost flatlined now for about 3 months. You know, people looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average saying, gosh, it's 18,000 and something every day for months, for a quarter. That's unheard of unless there's someone trying to stabilize things and keep the people satisfied.
Well, I'll tell you, things that would be very unstabilizing to the stock market. We've got Mohamed El-Erian, who suggested two things, a clean sweep with Democrats gaining control of both houses of Congress and of the White House, or at the other end of the spectrum, Donald Trump winning the presidency. The market has listened to the mainstream media and has basically said, we think that Hillary's going to win.
Right.
And so to be caught off guard at this point would to see a Trump election win, and the market wouldn't know what to do with that. What's interesting is you've got the State University of New York professor who says this, Trump now has an 87% chance of winning the election. And this is fascinating because he did some comprehensive analysis running a model on earlier campaigns, which comes up with the correct outcome for every race since 1912, except the 1960 election. And, it was Bill King that brought this to our attention, where he says the model didn't account for Chicago and Texas shenanigans. But what Professor Norpoth wrote is that although the race looks decided, current polling methods are bunk. Instead of opinion polling, Norpoth relies on his statistics from candidates' performance in the party primaries and in patterns within the electoral cycle to forecast the results. So again, he's only missed one election since 1912, and that was because some strange things were happening in Chicago and Texas.
Right.
Other than that one election, 1960, he's been spot on. And according to his stats, Trump has an 87% chance of winning. Now, factor that into, again, Elarian's comment that this could be massively disruptive and the markets could go haywire on a Trump victory. And it's mainly because the markets have no clue that that's even a possibility. They're listening to the mainstream media who's saying, look, he's going to get buried. It's all a bit embarrassing. Now let's talk about the House and Senate. We have better things to talk about now.
Well, and one indicator going back to the volatility index, it's called the VIX. If you go back and look at the 10-year treasury, just the movement of interest rates on the 10-year treasury, anytime the VIX, the volatility index, drops below their 3.95 floor, we seem to have a massive spike in volatility. Now, that happened in 2007. That happened in 2013 and 2014, where it hit 3.95. And then it spiked. Well, guess where we are right now?
About 3.95 on the 10-year treasury.
So something's going to change. Something's going to change. Whether it's Trump, whether it's Hillary, whether it's war, whether it's financial crisis, something's going to change in the next few weeks, probably.
You know, speaking of things that change, we have this strange and healthy dependence on technology, and we don't realize how much we've brought technology into our lives and how inseparable we are from it.
Unless we lose it.
That's right. So the Internet of Things, we were reminded this last week as a ton of your huge, massive websites were taken down.
It was half of America, Dave. Half of American websites.
Well, that's right. So we're talking about a concerted attack from Anonymous and another group that I'm less familiar with, New World. And they basically said this is retaliation for the Ecuadorian government's decision to cut off Julian Assange's Internet access.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically, on Friday, paralyzed half to two-thirds of the United States in terms of their Internet access to these particular sites. And the interesting thing, to do this sort of a DIN attack, they'll send messages from various Internet-connected devices to a server to cause a collapse in that particular site and a jam-up of that particular server.
And that server is like a bridge. The bridge basically goes to a number of sites, like in the case of Twitter, Reddit, the New York Times. Those were the sites that were affected amongst many others last week. Now, Dave, we're in our 40s and 50s, okay? If you actually talk to somebody in their 20s who is a gamer, who's on often, one of the techniques of gamers is to do this very thing to overwhelm, let's say, a team online. What they'll do is they'll co-opt a lot of other devices and they'll overwhelm them and knock them off the platform. This is something that gamers can do anytime they want. It doesn't take a Vladimir Putin. It doesn't take the deep, you know, recesses of the minds of the highest of technology. This is something that's going on all the time. It just was applied focused in a way to make a political statement.
You're basically creating an artificial bottleneck.
Yeah, that's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, and you're doing that by using, again, the Internet of Things, using devices which are Internet accessible, but have less security protocols on them because they're not usually data-specific machines.
Right. You're actually doing what Christie did, or he's been accused of doing, with a bridge between New York and New Jersey for political reasons. You basically just create a backlog or a jam where nothing can get through.
That's fascinating. Christie and Anonymous.
Well, I'm glad you brought the internet situation up from last Friday, because that actually is one of the areas where we could see volatility increase. I had read a report that traders in Wall Street had actually backed away from trading on Friday, thinking possibly that this attack on the internet would affect their trading practices.
Well, you might get stuck owning something for more than 5 seconds, and that could be tragic.
Well, that's true. In these days of high-frequency trading, where you can trade multiple times a second, you're exactly right. But when volatility increases, Dave, there's been something that's been bugging, I think, most of our listeners, and that is that gold has been stuck between 1250 and 1300. Now, underneath, the moving average, the 65-week moving average, has been nicely moving up, which is a confirmation of a bull market. But on the day-to-day basis, when we wake up and we look at the gold market, it doesn't seem like much is happening. Now, that can change. And, you know, one of the top voices actually for emerging markets and sort of looking forward in money management is a man named Mobius.
Well, he took the place of John Templeton at the Templeton Funds. He manages this specific little enclave within the Templeton Funds, the emerging markets.
And he likes gold right now.
Well, he does. He thinks 2017 will see gold rise an additional 15% from current levels, taking us above 1400, if I'm doing my math right. And we tend to agree, and for similar reasons too. We've talked about the importance of real rates, and this is his focus. It doesn't matter if you're moving interest rates up, if you're also moving inflation rates up, this is very significant. Carmen Reinhart, in our discussion with her, suggested that this was the direction the Fed was exploring at the last Jackson Hole consortium, and they basically said, yes, we need to start moving the inflation rate higher. Now, the euphemism for this is moving towards a high-powered economy, quote-unquote high-powered economy. Who doesn't want a high-powered economy?
Sure.
Everybody wants a high-powered economy. What are we voting on? When you go to your ballot and you're looking at Exhibit A, B, and C, and you're checking the box, remember that words have meaning and you may not understand the intended meaning. High-powered economy is something you'd say yes to all day long.
Except for what it really means is negative real rates of return.
That's right, because if you're driving inflation up, then the reality is what you make in terms of an interest rate, you subtract out the inflation rate, and now you're left at a zero or negative level.
Okay, so Dave, I'm a salesman. I'm the Federal Reserve, and I'm saying, okay, here's what I have to offer you. I want you to take out a bond. And you're going to say, well, how much are you going to pay me in interest? And I'll say, oh, no. I'm going to pay you negative 1% interest. You're going to laugh at me. But if I sit down and I say, okay, I'm going to pay you 3% interest.
Well,
and
that's
you're like,
better.
Well, what's the catch? And I'll be like, well, we're not going to talk about the 4% inflation. It's the same thing. If there's 4% inflation and I pay you 3% interest, that's the same thing as 0% inflation and me paying you negative one.
That's right. This is like magic and showmanship.
Right.
You're redirecting, you're causing someone to believe that something is happening when in fact the art of magic is doing something that no one understands or can perceive.
And this is what John Maynard Keynes said, not one in a million understands.
So to conclude, you've got Mobius saying, you look at real rates, and it doesn't matter if they start raising rates next year, because they're also raising the inflation target.
Right.
And so the reality is, gold will probably do quite well next year on that basis. And again, we tend to agree.
Dave, I'm going to use an analogy here to point this out. Pretend like you and I are playing a chess game. You represent China. I represent the United States. And we've been playing back and forth for the Pacific Theater. Okay, we're looking at the Pacific Theater. And of course, the United States, one of the key players in the United States, believe it or not, is the Philippine Islands. Okay, the Philippines being an ally for over 100 years, we're playing that piece as if it's our own. And pretend like that piece is directly in front of my king, and it's protecting my king. And so I'm sitting here going, all right, well, I've got the protection of this Philippine island, let's call it a pawn, whatever. And then I find out, wait a second, it's the other guy's piece. It's the other colored piece. No longer is it protection, but it's now a threat. That seems to be what has happened in the last couple of weeks between the United States and China and the playing piece called the Philippines.
Yeah, so this is where you've had basically a political catastrophe occur. It's like the change in the direction of a joke. You think you're going one direction, and then catastrophically it moves someplace else that you weren't expecting, and that's what causes laughter.
It's
because you thought you were following, and then a shock occurs.
Yeah.
The shock in the Philippines is Duterte. There's this fascinating shift on the Scarborough Shoal. I mean, just for context, you remember that following the end of the Spanish-American War, the Philippines became a U.S. colony. And they were a colony of the United States from 1898 to 1946.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, following us through the end of World War II. Now, we've got current events, which put in focus our conversations about Scarborough Shoal and the Chinese Nine-Dash Line.
Which is hotly contested between China and actually everyone else in the United Nations.
Well, and everyone else in Asia. China basically says all of the South China Sea is ours, and you've got all of these other countries who are bordering the South China Sea saying, wait, we have some maritime space here, and you're encroaching upon what is ours.
Right.
You know, you're talking about stuff that is 1,000 kilometers away from your shoreline and only 100 or 200 kilometers away from ours. We have a clear claim on this. And they say, no, the Nine-Dash Line makes it clear. We're basing this off of a historical map. Well, they made the map.
Right. And the international courts did not agree with China and actually gave a favorable ruling toward the Philippines.
That's right. So you've got the Philippines being handed a victory that pushes back on Chinese territorial ambitions in the South China Sea and establishes for the whole world a firm red line. And then you've got the Chinese who decide, it's just so fascinating, Kevin, that you remember that song, Can't Buy Me Love?
Right. Can't Buy Me Love.
Right. Well, it's simply not true. Or it's not going to be believed by the Chinese, right? Because you've got $24 billion now on the table with the Chinese, and Duterte, again, becomes that chess piece in your analogy, or this freak accident that occurs. We thought we were heading one direction,
right.
And now, based on the election, something radically has
I'm
just
no
shifted.
Longer an ally of America. I'm an ally of China.
Right. So, on the one hand, you've got Duterte, who's been pressured by Obama and the U.S. State Department to play sort of an appropriate role in America's Pacific strategy, I suppose, if you can call it that. And on the other hand, we then discover that Duterte is being wooed by the Chinese and prefers the Chinese to the Americans.
And you're talking $24 billion. That's sort of an enticement to get this thing to shift.
That's right. $24 billion in cheap funds from the Chinese to start with. And there's no doubt more intriguing trade deals will follow. But China has promised to increase its imports from the Philippines. That includes fruit. I'm thinking of my dad here because he just can't get enough of the mangoes from Cebu.
Who, by the way, your father, for those who don't know, lives in the Philippines.
That's right. And we all love mangoes in our family. One thing I discovered this last year, just as an anecdote, is that mangoes are in the same family as poison ivy. You never want to pick them ripe or eat them too ripe because that white, milky substance that comes from the stem has the same exact reaction on your skin as poison ivy because they are, in fact, from the same family as poison ivy.
Well, good to know.
I know. Well, Duterte, what he's going to do is he's going to establish rail lines. He's going to build out other infrastructure projects with inexpensive loans from the Chinese. And of course, that allows him to put people to work. It deepens his domestic appeal by being able to create jobs doing infrastructure projects funded by the Chinese. And the tragedy here is the shift in loyalty to China at the expense of, I mean, to be quite honest, it's an aged relationship and it's long been taken for granted by U.S. diplomats. So the world moves on from past debts and the Philippines, the Filipino people move on from past debts, if you will. We save their bacon through the war and now all of a sudden they just have no use for us. Duterte said this, I'm literally quoting him. I announce my separation from the United States. Interestingly, this is another feather for the Obama cap.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the thing is, whether a person agrees with imperialism, call it what you want, there's a stability that comes from knowing your allies. And, you know, we talked to Dr. George Friedman sometimes from Stratford, and he also looks at the world, I had mentioned, like a chessboard, but he looks at it from a power standpoint. And when you lose a key player like the Philippines, if that is actually happening, and it seems like it is, then it destabilizes the whole world.
Our current foreign policy continues to remake the modern world. And you see that in the Middle East. Now you're seeing it more in Asia. And it is destabilizing, not only for the next administration who sort of inherits this, but also for the next generation.
Hmm.
Because loyalty isn't something you ever want to lose. And you have to say rarely when it is lost, can you get it back? Bloomberg late last week quoted the Filipino Communications Secretary Martin Andanar as saying, China is not only a friend, China is not only a relative, but China is a big brother.
Hmm.
And you have to wonder, for us here in America, does this alter our military presence in the Philippines, a very strategic location for us in the past? Does it change U.S. support efforts in the Southern Islands? Because for a long time, we've been helping the Filipino military to suppress Abu Sayyaf and the growing Islamic radicalism in Mindanao, in the southern end of the archipelago. And as recently as March, I mean, again, Duterte is an X factor. We signed the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement with the Philippine government in, I think, March of this year. And then June, Duterte takes the oath of office. And that quickly, between June and now, we went from having an ally that we were going to start using 8 different military bases in cooperation with them to him saying, I announce my separation from the United States. What are the implications there? I hope we're not reading too much into it. But you look at the Scarborough Shoal, and it is strategically located in the north, close to the old U.S. military bases, which were throughout Luzon, the northern part of the Philippines. And now the Chinese, in spite of the Hague's ruling, are going to proceed with building out a presence there. And they're agreeing to all the free access for Filipino fishermen in and around the shoal, which was really the deeply contested part. They don't want to give up their old fishing rights.
Well, and we've talked about the Scarborough Shoal and this particular tension for several years, especially the last few months, being possibly a military concern. But what we're seeing right now is when the economic overpowers the military. So instead of it being guns and bullets, what we're talking about is $24 billion plus probably future loans.
Well, that's right. And that's what we conclude, that the wars of the 21st century are far more likely to be financial and economic in nature. And, you know, we've mentioned Juan Zarate's book, Treasury's War, in the past, where he highlights the role of the U.S. Treasury in destabilizing various regimes around the world. Again, bringing in the financial and economic as the tip of the spear in terms of war. And here we see this again, an economic shift of this nature is of great significance.
Yeah.
It's like losing a battlefield ally. Like you said, you think you've got a good defense until you realize that they've been co-opted, and actually, you've got betrayal right in front of you.
Well, another form of this warfare, we've talked to Jim Rickards about this, is currency wars. And the Chinese currency has been pegged to the dollar so that we haven't really fought a currency war necessarily with China for many years. But what we're seeing is a depreciation of the Chinese currency at this point. So that brings in another dynamic to what we're talking about.
Yeah, you've got the Chinese currency depreciated probably 4.2% year to date. And, you know, just as a habit, I read Doug Nolan's comments at the end of every week. And I highly recommend you do the same.
Oh, they're very intelligent.
The Credit Bubble Bulletin, well, he's been writing since the mid-90s when he was writing with Kurt Rischebacher, a great credit analyst. And then he started actually the Credit Bubble Bulletin in 99. For the past decade, I do this every day. Part of my daily routine is going to his site and looking at the consolidated news articles pertaining to the bear case. So this last week, he explored an interesting set of numbers from China, and I just want to share those with you. You've got real estate, in spite of the best efforts of the state of China, who's trying to cool prices, who's trying to end speculative excess in the real estate sector, they've continued to see a move up in the value of real estate prices, seemingly defying gravity.
Yeah.
So year-on-year price increases were up in Shenzhen, 34.1%, in Shanghai, 32.7%, and 27.8% in Beijing.
Dave, that's like a $300,000 home here in America going to $400,000.
In a year.
In a year.
Right. So I want to bring those price moves into sort of a relationship with U.S. house prices, just for perspective, so it makes sense to us here in the U.S. If you look at the average price of a house here in the United States and compare it to household disposable income and create a ratio, you've got a ratio in China of 18 to 20. In the U.S., it's 5.25. In other words, a U.S. home is 5.25 times current disposable income.
And China's 18 to 20
times current disposable income. So if we were priced in the United States like first-tier Chinese cities at that 18 to 20 times number, you'd be talking about the average single home price in the U.S. selling for between $810,000 and $900,000 a piece. Yeah, not San Francisco real estate. We're talking about across the entire country.
So it sounds very overvalued.
Is there a bubble in Chinese real estate? So again, let's look at comparisons. And this is compliments of Doug. In London, it takes 29 years of the median income to buy the median priced home. Using every dollar of income, it'll take you 29 years to pay it off. So you could say, yes, real estate in London is very expensive. Tokyo, 23 years. New York, 15. Sydney, 12. and Shenzhen, well, on this basis, you're actually more expensive than London because it'll take you 41 years of median income, the average income, to pay off the average home price in Shenzhen. It's 34 years in Beijing, 32 in Shanghai. And this is really important because returning to sort of those year-on-year increases, that 30% plus right. change from last year, you've got to understand the importance of the rate of change.
Right. It seems like the curve is steepening. It's almost going vertical.
That's right. So when you measure rainfall for a year, its distribution is important, right? Does 36 inches of rain come over a 9-month period? Or does it come over a 9-day period?
Well, the difference is between just regular rain and flood, like what we saw in the south here over the last couple of weeks.
Oh, that's right. In the first case, the distribution is manageable. In the latter, you're right. You're talking about a major flood. The same thing applies to price increases. If a price increases gradually over a long period of time, that's relatively stable. But if that gradual move then becomes more and more rapid at a later stage, you're moving towards what is ultimately an unsustainable rate of price change.
So like shooting an arrow into the air, what goes up does come down.
Right. I mean, or imagine launching a car off of a ramp. Your maximum acceleration combined with maximum ramp angle launches the vehicle into space. There is an apex. Mm. There is a peak point where velocity is at its max and then energy is lost. And markets are no different. You've got flows of liquidity which drive prices, and prices can increase more and more quickly, but to sustain that, it takes more and more liquidity. And the same thing happened in Japanese real estate. There were maximum thresholds where you got to thousands of dollars per square foot.
Right.
And then you basically ran out of buyers.
Yeah, and that was in the late 80s, Dave. I remember your dad getting up in one of our meetings back, I don't know, 88, 89, and he was talking about Tokyo real estate being thousands of dollars per square foot. Now, that was the stalling point of Tokyo. That was the apex of what you're talking about. We really haven't seen that return ever since.
You ran out of energy. You ran out of buyers. You ran out of people who were willing to step in and keep on driving the price even higher. And you might say that in the case of the Chinese, look, you've got a massive migration occurring. You've got people coming in from the farm, from rural areas, and they're moving to the city. Mm-hmm. And that kind of migration is going to keep demand steady. But here's the question. They don't have the money.
Right.
Right. We're not talking about the rich, the leisure class moving from their country estates into their city apartments. No, no. You have to ask, where does the money come from?
Right.
Ag workers from the interior are not your best quality buyer. They don't have the most reliable means of paying back loans.
Dave, what this reminds me of is the subprime movement that we saw back in the 90s and into the early 2000s, where people were being given loans with no real means of paying them back.
This is the point. You've got new loan growth for September, which was double the forecast figures. It was up 30% from the previous month. And again, an unsustainable rate of change is marked by not only a rapid price increase, but also a surge in transactions. Mm-hmm. And you've got the Chinese who are figuring out now how to arrange a line of credit with no questions asked as to usage, to then use those resources for the down payment, financing the remainder with your more traditional mortgage loan. So again, does this sound like 2006, 2007?
Oh my gosh, it sounds like a subprime loan problem in China, but larger than ours.
Right. No skin in the game, 100% financed. How might that end? Bang or whimper? And we could certainly share from our experience on that front.
Well, you know, somebody that we've talked to on a number of occasions, Stephen Roach, who seems to be an expert on China, he has in the past warned that a lot of the growth is unsustainable. How is Roach approaching this?
On the other hand, he remains relatively optimistic longer term for China. So he would not be counted as a China bear.
Right.
He might be one of the remaining China bulls, which is not to say they have sort of a clean and easy path ahead, but he's not convinced that they can't sort of manage their way through this transition to a service-based instead of a manufacturing-based economy.
Well, you've brought up in the past, though, the China numbers are played with just like our numbers are played with. I mean, the 6.7% growth, is that a real number? Is that something to take into account?
Well, and so again, that relates to Stephen Roach's more optimistic comments. I'm uncertain as to whether he still considers the official growth rate, that 6.7%, the genuine article or something like a Louis Vuitton knockoff. It's great looking, but it's not real.
Right.
I mean, in China is good at those. You know that. 6.7%. If that number proves false, You're talking about very, very significant implications. The IMF has actually, in their most recent report out October, 289-page report on the global economy, they have an entire chapter which is designated for spillover effects from China. Okay. So they're realizing that as China has grown in economic importance in terms of their share of the global economy, if something goes wrong in China, there's also ramifications for other countries.
Well, and let me just remind everyone, including myself, that China has been seen over the last decade as the great hope to pull us out of this financial crisis, because we really don't have growth in America. We don't have growth in Europe. China has shown at least a high GDP number. And so the hope was that China would be the next horse in the game.
Well, and that was particularly the popular meme between 2009, 10, and 11, because while we were on our backs and trying to figure out how to finance our way out of the global financial crisis, they went straight to spending initiatives, $1 trillion, $2 trillion. Basically, it was the largest financing binge on record.
But the point is, we're not just talking about China. We're talking about the global economy here.
Well, right. The IMF pencils in the Chinese share of the global economy at 17.3%, which means that if they are growing their economy at 6.7%, Roach does the math and says, you're contributing 1.2 percentage points of global growth, of world growth. You know, so you look at their percentage share of the total economy, how much it's growing, and 1.2 percentage points of all of global growth is coming from the Chinese, which is basically half.
Okay, but what if real estate does apex out and start turning down?
Right. Without that large number, whether it's real or not, the headlines around the world would already read global recession. If the real estate market moves in reverse, like you're suggesting, loan growth contracts instead of expands in China, you would find a very sharp contraction. And in the place of that rosy 6.7% figure, guess what? You've got a negative domino effect into your resource economies. You've got Australia, you've got New Zealand, Canada, Russia, and Brazil. And all those countries actually right now are already between a rock and a hard place for a variety of reasons.
But they're very dependent on China continuing to grow.
That's right, because they export a lot of their resources, and China's been an importer of many of those resources. But it also, when you're looking at those countries, it also suggests anecdotally that Chinese growth rates are, in fact, garbage. If they're between a rock and a hard place, strong growth in China or not, you'd see ancillary support for that thesis in these trade partners' economies, and you're not seeing it. So, again, those countries I just listed, they make up another 9% of global GDP, and they're already a drag on growth. It can get worse. It can get worse for them if the Chinese economy deteriorates. Roach also notes, Stephen Roach, by the way, is no longer at Morgan Stanley. He's teaching economics at Yale. And he'd be a good economics professor because he's kind of a guy who's been in the trenches, not just in theory, but he's been an operator in the financial markets and kind of understands beyond theory what happens in practice. If I were studying economics, he would be an interesting guy to
What I'd really like from Stephen Roach isn't just an economics education, but actually his frequent flyer miles, Dave, because if I remember right,
Roach, million a year.
Roach complained to you that he was always on the plane when you would interview him.
A million miles a year means that in retirement, he can fly anywhere he wants for free, right? But what I was saying is that Roach is also interested in the interconnectedness of Asian trading partners with China. So we already talked about Duterte and China and improving trade relations with the Philippines. We talked about that earlier. But these interconnected Asian relationships would include the Philippines, Indonesia, Thailand, Japan, Korea, Taiwan. And this is another 11% of global GDP. So let's tie this all together. Tied to Chinese growth stats, you've got 17.3%. That's their contribution to the global economy. 9% from your resource-based economies. Another 11% coming from your Asian trade partners. 37.3% of the global economy
is just this China conglomerate.
Is very closely tied to China.
Yeah.
And so you're knocking on 40%, and we haven't even mentioned U.S.-Chinese trade relationships, where China is now the third largest export market for the U.S. Do you realize that? And the fastest growing export market for the United States. The bottom line is this. We've got our friend, the Chinese economist Peter Chow, who says that these growth statistics are way too generous. They're not reality. Then we've got our regular commentary guest, Michael Pettis, who lives in Beijing, teaches finance there. These growth statistics, according to him, are way too generous. What does this lead us to conclude? that the confidence that some economists have of a return to a growth path in the global economy is way too optimistic at this point. Way too optimistic. And in fact, if you look under the hood, we probably are just about where we were circa 2008 and 2009, if not just slightly above that level.
Well, and this brings us back to a difficult question, okay? Because if China isn't the horse that's going to get us out of this, we have to go back to the dollar, okay? Which strangely enough continues to stay strong. It looks like there's really no competition for the dollar, even as weak as it should be, because everyone else is falling apart too.
Well, that's right. So it's strong on a relative basis, not necessarily on an absolute basis. We go back to the dollar for a minute. The euro sells off, now sitting around 108. And it looks like it's ready to make new lows, breaking below 104.
Which is new highs for the dollar against the euro.
Yeah, that's right. And the dollar relative to the pound and euro, again, is doing very well. The dollar is, according to our late friend Ian McCavity, the best looking horse in the glue factory.
I loved it when Ian McCavity used to say that. Now, Dave, you're just about to head to the New Orleans conference. And actually, I sort of had a somber thought this morning, but, this is the first time you're ever going to go to the New Orleans conference when Ian McCavity's not there. This is the first year.
That's right. I don't think he missed it for 40 years. He was there when my dad was regularly going to the conference and speaking at it, and when I was as well. And I'll go again this year. I'm looking forward to having dinner with David Tice and Robert Prechter and the Aiden sisters and Gary Alexander.
But there will be a gap this time,
Dave. There will be.
There'll be a gap because Ian McCavity was almost a personality that represented that conference, if you think about it.
That's right. Sitting next to Adrian Day on one side and Ian McCavity on the other. You know, last time we had dinner, Robert Prechter was teaching my son Declan Fibonacci numbers and how to use Fibonacci numbers in trading.
And Declan is 11.
Hey, not yet. He's just 10. But soon enough. He was 9 at the time. But we're going to miss McCavity.
I always loved the way he turned a phrase and what you were talking about, the best looking horse in a glue factory. That said it all for the dollar.
Right. At present, there's an issue with the dollar, though. And it's that we're running into dollar shortages in the overseas markets. Carmen Reinhart, who was on with us a few months ago, Carmen Reinhart highlights in a brand new Project Syndicate article that it was the Marshall Plan, which was designed to relieve dollar shortages after the war.
To provide liquidity in a sound currency at the time.
That's right. There were dollar shortages in Europe, and the Marshall Plan brought that liquidity in. And we saw a similar lack of dollar liquidity emerge during the global financial crisis. So just 2008, 2009. Now, in a number of cases, this is reemerging. We have dollar shortages in Egypt, Nigeria, Iran, Angola, Uzbekistan, and South Sudan, according to Carmen Reinhart. And of course, all of these are sort of problematic spots from a political standpoint. And there's a twist which Carmen introduces in a brilliant way. I read through the whole article and honestly, it was like chewing on chalk until the last sentence. And then she makes the suggestion, in each case of dollar shortage, either a black market emerges or a parallel market for foreign exchange emerges. And her insinuation is that the Chinese may fill the liquidity gap.
Well, no, this is important, Dave, because this is new. No one has used Chinese currency in the past that I know of as a black market currency.
Or to run in a parallel track with the U.S. currency and fill the gap of liquidity. So Roach sees a managed transition to a service economy. He sees that as predictable. It's not an easy transition. It's certainly not fait accompli. You have Duterte, who's shifting alliances financially towards China. Apparently, love of a certain sort can be paid for, it would seem. And the extension of the RMB, the Chinese currency, into these far-flung geographies, into places that the Chinese are more willing to invest, it may allow for an appetite for yuan or RMB, whichever you want to call it. It may allow that appetite to grow, for usage to increase, for distribution to occur, given the dollar liquidity gap, which needs to be filled.
Well, and we've talked about the SDR, you know, the inclusion of the yuan in the SDR. One of the questions that was probably overplayed this fall was, that the dollar was going to collapse because the yuan was now going to be added to the SDR with the IMF. Now, we poo-pooed that every time we were asked about that. We said, no, 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 it's not going to collapse the dollar. But there is, just like there was with the euro, there is a displacement over time of the dollar share of world currency trading. Now, how is that important? Well, the dollar's not backed by gold anymore. It's losing its reserve currency status.
So if there's not enough dollars to go around in these far-flung geographies and the Chinese currency begins to run on a parallel track with the US dollar, it's not that the SDR displaces the dollar from global importance, but it's just a liquidity strain, which requires something to occur. What is that something?
The habits get changed.
And again, this is Carmen Reinhart's suggestion, is that, yes, there is nature abhorring a vacuum yet again. And it seems that whether it is, in our opinion, comprehensive foreign policy, which has been lacking, or in her opinion, currency shortage, the Chinese are deftly filling gaps.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.